because the invitation is to meet with God, the first three being Passover, unyeasted bread, and firstborn children. Pesach, Matzah, and Bukkudim are either the lone means to salvation, the lone way to engage in a relationship with Yahweh, the only way to become part of His family and to become immortal, to become vindicated, and to be adopted into His home. There just is no other option. The Torah is right. That's it. So it behooves us to focus on the Torah, to determine whether or not the Torah can be trusted. Because if the Torah was inspired by God, as God claims, as Yosha claims, if the Torah was inspired by God, if the Torah can be trusted, there's only one means to engage in a relationship with God. There's only one means to be saved by God. And it is by way of these seven invitations to meet with Him, the first three of which we will celebrate beginning this Sunday at sundown. When it became apparent that the universe was created in a Big Bang, which is exactly what God had said and exactly what scientists had claimed did not happen, it should have been game over for those who pitted science against God. It was a debate. The scientists lost. God prevailed. But when the Wilkinson microwave probe determined that since the time that light coalesced to form matter, because all we can do is we can measure time from the moment that light coalesced to form matter, because prior to that time, time isn't measurable. That's why scientists will say, you know, we're going to say it's a fraction of a second. It was an inflationary period. They can't measure it. That's the truth. Before time, light became matter, because God claims that He created the universe, light materialized, light became matter. But until it became matter, time didn't flow. And from the moment that occurred, scientists tell us that time was stretched by 10 to the 12th power. Now, absolute proof that the Torah is truthful. All you have to do is multiply. Now, scientists say that the Big Bang, which is when light cooled, energy cooled enough to become matter, occurred just shy of 14 billion years ago. They're changing the date routinely, going upwards in time, just prior to 14 billion years ago. So take 14 billion years, multiply 365 and a quarter days per year, and then divide that by 10 to the 12th, and see what you get. And when you get a number that's approaching 6, you recognize Yahweh was telling the truth, that we're still in the sixth day of creation. And if you don't do that, then don't blame God for not proving that He exists. Don't blame God for not proving that He didn't author His Torah. You're just choosing to be either lazy or ignorant. But when that number became evident, it should have been over. For anybody who is informed and rational, it should be over at that point. Then you come to the flood. Oh, of course, historians and academicians want you to believe that the flood story is based upon a Babylonian tale, the Gilgamesh epic. But I've read it. I've read what's on those tablets. And first of all, there's not a single one of those tablets that predates the Torah. Not one. And second of all, there is a 99.9% discord between the stories. There's a few details that are in common amongst a story that is 99.9% different. In fact, not just different, the opposite of one another. To make the claim that the Torah's account was derived from that is to be either ignorant or irrational. One or the other. But beyond that, the to say that it didn't occur is to be unaware of what God said happened and what we now know happened. We now know that 3,000 BCE, 5,000 years ago, an asteroid impacted the Earth near the mouth of the Tigris and Euphrates rivers off of the Indian subcontinent. We find that the crater for it, which is called the Burkle Crater, thousands of feet below the surface of the sea, is tens of miles across. And they can calculate the size of the tsunami that would have resulted. And they can calculate the size, the amount of debris that would have entered the atmosphere, and how long it would have rained, and what it would have done to that region. And all God says is that it was the region outside of Eden that was flooded. And the region outside of Eden, because he identifies Eden, it's in eastern Turkey under Lake Van, and talked about how civilization then migrated from that point along the Tigris and Euphrates rivers. He even says that there were human communities, towns, and civilizations even while Adam and Chawa existed in the garden. And he says they were flooded. And what do we find? That's the time that the Burkle Crater hit. We find that God said that the flood was started by an upwelling of seawater. We even find God saying that it was only humans with an Asama, which means they would have had to have been related to the exiled Adam and Chawa, that were killed. We find even that the Black Sea, which would have been ground zero for the most devastating part of this, where the first civilizations were at the time, we find that it turns from fresh to salt water 5,000 years ago, right when God said it would. We find that the water level raised about 500 feet at that time. Every aspect of what he said is accurate. We've even found the ark. If you want to see it, you can even Google it. Google Maps will show it to you. I have. I've looked at it. I've actually seen the pieces of the ark that were brought back by Ron Wyatt. Read all the evidence of his story. It's all there. Demonstrated before our very eyes. Every aspect of the Torah is valid. All the peoples that it said that the children of Israel interacted with have been shown to have existed. For many years, proof that the Torah was a fable was the story of the Hittites and the civilization of the Hittites and how the Hittites interacted with the children of Israel. And yet, about 50 years ago, overwhelming evidence was found for the Hittites. Their cities have been unearthed. Their clay tablets have been found. All been shown to be true. That being the case, it's also a book filled with prophecy, for God predicted what was going to happen. As a matter of fact, the creation account speaks of the 7 days of humankind on this planet. The 7 days from the time that representing 7,000 years from the time that Adam and Chawa were booted out of the garden to the time that we returned to the garden, 6,000 years between being booted out and returning, then 1,000 years of celebrating the entire earth being returned to conditions experienced in the garden. Every aspect of it's prophetic, including the fourth day that so many atheists are wont to say proves that the Torah's account is invalid. They all have their chapters devoted to claiming that plants were created on the third day, allegedly, and the sun was created on the fourth day, which is stupid. And they say, so that proves that the Torah's account is invalid. But God said that plants were created on the third day. And if you look at human history and you calibrate it to a time clock based upon a witness at creation, they were. And that as a result of the plants, but also as a result of the diminished bombardment of the Earth by orbit intersecting asteroids and comets and meteorites, as well as a diminishment in volcanoes and tectonic earthquake plate activity, that over a period of time, as a direct result of those things and the benefit of the plants, our atmosphere became transparent. It hadn't been previously. And when it became transparent, as God said on the fourth day of creation, that the sun and the moon became visible. And he said they became visible as signs of the greater and lesser lights. A sign for the meeting times, these moed, these dates that God has established for us to meet with him. It's what happened scientifically, but more important prophetically. It was in the fourth era from the time, 4,000 years from the time that Adam and Chawa were booted out of the garden to the time, the very day that Yosha, the diminished manifestation of God, walked into Jerusalem to fulfill the first four of these Mikrae, the first three of which we're celebrating next week. Right on schedule, just as he had predicted. When that occurred in the fourth millennium of human history, right on time, on the exact date, why didn't the world say, God has proved the validity of his Torah? And the moment you accept the validity of the Torah, once you come to read it and calibrate it with science and history, once you accept the fact that its testimony is impossible other than being inspired, then you're confronted by a single covenant that was presented in only one place in the first book of that Torah between Yahweh and Abraham. And there you read about the five conditions that Abraham accepted and the five benefits that God promised. And you're told that this one covenant is forever, will always exist. The benefits are God's promise to us. The benefits just happen to coincide with the first four Mikrae, the Mikrae that have already, these invitations to meet with God, that have already been honored by Yahweh. And so what God has told us is that he authored his Torah instruction, his Torah guidance, and that is where we go if we wish to know him. That is what we observe if we wish to understand what he is offering. It is the one place we can learn so that we then can accept his covenant and the one place we can go to accept his invitation. I'm no longer going to say if the Torah is valid because we've been through many of the evidences that prove the Torah is valid. You can't make a sane argument that the creator of the universe didn't inspire the Torah. And that being the case, we find that the Torah begins after God introduces himself to us by name, by title, by purpose, so that we can come to know him. That it presents the single most important thing in God's from God's perspective, which is the covenant. It means a family-oriented relationship. That's all God cares about. The universe exists so that God could enjoy a family. The covenant is that family. There's only one of them. It will never be changed. There's only one. It is the covenant. Which means this notion of a Christian New Testament is completely inconsistent with the Torah. And since God authored the Torah, there is no validity to it. The basis of Christianity is torn asunder. Moreover, Christianity does not answer any of these invitations which are required if you want to engage in a relationship with God, if you want to be saved by God. Now, I use the term required, even though I said there's no Hebrew word for obey. The fact of the matter is that God doesn't order us to attend these invitations. He offers them. We are free to reject his offer, ignore his offer, or accept his offer. They are, after all, invitations. We can respond or not. The choice is ours alone. But there's a consequence, depending on what we choose to do. If you respond to these invitations to meet with him, you understand what they represent, you meet with God on these days and celebrate their benefit, then God has promised by way of his covenant to make your soul immortal, to perfect your soul, vindicating you, saving you, to adopt you into his family, to enrich you and to empower you. Ultimately, he's doing so because the final of these Moed Mikra, these invitations to meet with God, enable us to camp out together for all time with the creator of the universe. It's the only means to achieve these things. God tells us that if we do not avail ourselves of these, that the consequence is that we're going to die and or be estranged from him. You can be estranged from God and die, which means that there is no penalty. You just wasted your life. You chose to be interested in other things and God wasn't among them. You chose to allow yourself to be poisoned by academic institutions where you lost the ability to exercise good judgment. You're no longer discerning. You believed others when they said that this was valid or wasn't valid. So if you choose just to ignore the invitations, as 99% of humanity has done and continues to do, for either religious reasons, political reasons, or you've got other things that are more important, then at the end of your life will be over. That's the consequence. You don't know God. God doesn't know you. You're not engaged in a relationship with him, and then nothing is going to solve that problem. If you take a different point of view, however, and you say that you are no longer interested in just ignoring what God has to say, being beguiled about what God has to say, but you become a beguiler. You change. We had the other day, we had an advocate of Hebrew roots calling the program, and he wanted to promote the Hebrew roots religion. Well, that's very different than a person who is victimized. You know, a person can have been fooled by Hebrew roots, that is a blend of rabbinical Judaism and Pauline Christianity, can be fooled by those things and say that I've got some questions. Could you explain why Yahweh's testimony is in opposition to Hebrew roots? Could you answer these questions? But that wasn't the approach. No, that person was a promoter of Hebrew roots, which means now they are in opposition to the Torah, which is why they were so flabbergasted that the Torah actually says that it's the source of salvation. Because Pauline Christianity says exactly the opposite. So if you're an advocate for religion, if you are calling radio shows and deceiving on behalf of others as it relates to God's offer, there's a different outcome. The point I want to make is that if you are in opposition to the Torah being Yahweh's foundation, the basis of his guidance and instruction to humankind, the means to know him, the means to understand the covenant that he is offering, the means to meet with him, to know when and how and where to meet with him so that you can be part of his eternal family. If you're opposed to that, as are the Hebrew roots individuals, as are Messianic Christians, because they both embrace Paul, who is overtly in opposition to it, as are all Christians, whether they be Orthodox or Evangelical or Protestant, because their New Testament is based upon Paul's letters, and Paul was the adversary. He was, by his own admission, demon-possessed, inspired by Satan. So if you are in opposition to it and you advocate that opposition through teaching, through media, through a religious environment, whatever it might be, and you lead people aside by your false witness, then for that there is a consequence. Those individuals don't simply cease to exist upon their death. They are forever incarcerated in Sheol. So you ought to be really careful if you move to promoting religious deception as opposed to being just victimized by it. You're victimized by it, you squandered your opportunity, you squandered your life. But if you promote it, you'll become eternally incarcerated in Sheol along with other religious individuals. So be really careful when that happens. Now, with that foundation, let me share with you the five requirements to participate in the covenant and the five benefits of the covenant, and let's equate to those to these first four invitations, the first three of which we'll celebrate next week. To participate in the covenant, the first requirement is to walk away from religion and politics, from your country. To no longer being political, to no longer being patriotic, to no longer being militaristic. To give up on the societal customs of religion and politics. You must walk away from them first. God is not going to allow anyone into his family that is religious or political, that is patriotic, that is militaristic. Otherwise, heaven would be no better than earth. That is a prerequisite. It is also a prerequisite on understanding. I have found universally that a person who advocates religion, who isn't willing to distance themselves from religion, who isn't at the point yet that they're even willing to question their religion, as opposed to the mandated requirement to walk away from it, that there is no amount of evidence and reason that will reach them. You can't help them. You can, however, reach someone who is now questioning their religion. And there are 1,000 triggers to prove that Christianity is wrong, any one of which could trigger an open mind to be receptive. But that's the first requirement. The second requirement, and again, I want to use the term requirement because they are requirements. That doesn't mean God is ordering you to obey. It's your choice. You have the opportunity. This is not a military construct where if you disobey a command that there is an immediate consequence. You lose your freedom, your money, or your life. That's not the case here. These are instructions. They're guidance. They're offers. But they are rules of the home. You either accept them or you are not invited in. The second is that you come to trust and rely upon Yahweh. It is really related to the first. Distancing yourself from politics and religion is important. That's why we do the first hour of the show as we do. And it's at least a step in the right direction. But for that step to have merit, you need to find out who Yahweh is. And that's why I talk about the Torah. It's the only place he introduces himself. The only place that God can be known is through his Torah. And then you need to understand what he's offering so you can choose to trust and rely on it. Faith is not at issue here. Faith is belief in the unknown. It's the response to people who do not know and who do not understand. God is knowable. His offer can be understood. And when you know and you understand, then you can trust and rely. And the second condition of the covenant of being part of Yahweh's family is to trust and rely on him. And it should be understood that from the perspective of instead of trusting and relying upon one's government or one's religion. They are in lieu of one another. It's one or the other. You can never have both. There is no pope in heaven. Every pope is in hell. Moving to the third, God says, walk to him and become perfect. And that is where we intersect these invitations to meet with God. They are a path. They are a way. They are the only path. They are the only way. It is six steps that we take to God. With the seventh, we end up in his presence. It is 6 + 1 = 7. It is the commemoration of the creation account. It is the reason that there are six steps to God, and the seventh, we camp out in his presence. It is the only way to God. And God says, walk to him and become perfect. It is the second of these three Moed Mikre, these invitations to meet with God that we are going to celebrate beginning at the beginning of next week, starting this Sunday evening, Monday and Tuesday, and for a week-long event of celebration beginning at sundown on Sunday. The trio of days, Pesach, Matzah, and Bikurim, are all summarized by Yahweh as matzah, as unyeasting us of our souls, of the corruption of religion and politics. And so it is for 7 days that we celebrate this, and it is in recognition that by God removing the stain of sin from our souls, we become perfect in God's eyes, exonerated. It's not because we follow a rule. It's not because we do what the Torah says. It's not because of obedience. It's because that's the provision. The provision is if you meet with God on matzah following Passover, that you become perfect in God's eyes. He does what is required to remove the penalty of sin, which is separation from God. That's why on Passover, the Passover lamb's body paid the price to resolve the issue of our mortality. And the following day, we are perfected, where Yahusha's soul paid the penalty going to Sheol in our stead so we wouldn't be separated. We are perfected. So when God says, walk to me and become perfect, that's what he's talking about. It's matzah. The fourth requirement to participate in the covenant is to observe the covenant, to do what we're doing right now, to come to understand its presentation in the Torah. It's the only place you can observe it, to understand what was asked of Abraham, what Abraham did, what he accepted, and then what the benefits of that covenant are. They're only presented in the Torah, and God says is the fourth requirement. Observe it. Observe it doesn't mean to keep. It means to observe. What is to observe? It's a fairly simple concept, right? Use your eyes to read. Use your mind to consider. Closely examine and carefully consider. The Torah's presentation of the covenant is the only way that you can meet that particular requirement to be part of God's family. Again, it's your choice. But if you want to be part of God's family, that's what is required. And lastly, as parents, God says he wants us to circumcise our sons, not our daughters, our sons, so that we and they remember the covenant as the sign of the covenant, that we're going to raise our children to become God's children. It's our single greatest priority. He's equating us coming together as men and women, as mother and father, as husband and wife, to conceive and raise children in a loving home, and the single most important thing we as parents can do on behalf of our children. That's why circumcision is the sign of the covenant. Those are the five requirements. The five benefits of the covenant just happen to be provided by the first four Moed Mikre, these invitations to meet with God. The first is that we become immortal. That's the result of observing Passover. Second, we become perfect. That's the result of observing, of benefiting from matzah, unyeasted bread. And third, we're adopted into Yahweh's family, the first family, as his children, which occurs on Bikurim, firstborn children. And then God says to Abraham and to us through him, as a result of those things, that he's going to enrich our lives with his guidance, with his teaching. Ultimately, he's going to write his Torah right inside of us, making it part of the fabric of our lives. But right now, we can do that on our own by studying his Torah teaching. It will enrich you. It will make you smarter, wiser, more knowledgeable. It will make your life more joyful. It will free you. It will enlighten you. He has provided the means to enrich your life and to empower you. When we become God's children, we're ultimately empowered. Ultimately, we will transcend mortality and being corporeal, material, and we will become like God and become energy-based and light. That's the promise. Those five promises or benefits of the covenant are delivered by way of the first four Moed Mikre. That is what we're celebrating. The first three we celebrate beginning this Sunday night at sundown. It will be the 14th day of the first month on God's calendar. Now, the timing of this is important. God tells us that it is in the month of Abib. Abib enables us to use a moon phase to determine and to determine a time in a solar year because of Abib. Abib is the time that the first grain, barley, begins to grow, and the kernel of the grain, the valuable part of the grain, is growing and receptive and not yet hard, where it is unreceptive. That occurs right around the spring equinox. And so if we find the renewal of the moon's light, because God said this is Kadesh, a time of renewal, when the light is renewed on the surface of the moon, closest to that time of year, we count that would be the first day of Abib, 14 days from the conclusion of Shattering Myths for this week. If you're going to celebrate Pesach, Matzah, and Bukurim beginning this Sunday evening in three successive days, so celebrating the overall benefit of unyeasted bread for 7 days beginning this Sunday night. First, if you are male and you are not circumcised, do not do it. It would be counterproductive for you, and God specifically forbids it. Unless you have the sign of the covenant, you should not participate in Passover, because without the sign of the covenant, you are excluded from the covenant, which means you're excluded from God's home. You don't want to get the benefit of Pesach, of Passover, without being included in God's home, because that would mean eternal separation. It would be extraordinarily counterproductive. If you are a male and are not circumcised, do not do this. If you're a male and are circumcised but are still religious in any religion, socialist, secular humanism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, do not participate. Because if you are still religious, it means that you are not a participant in the covenant, and the same status applies. If you have left your religion, if you have disassociated from your country, and you are, as a male, circumcised, or a woman who has done these things, then you are invited to meet with God at sundown on the 14th day of the month of Abib. That will occur as the sun sets on Sunday evening this year. And it is a time for us to grill lamb and consume lamb and to drink wine and to eat unyeasted bread with bitter herbs. All of this is symbolic. What it tells us that we are doing is we're recognizing the sacrifice of the sacrificial lamb, Yahusha, the diminished manifestation of Yahweh, that we're recognizing the sacrifice that he made and the benefit of that sacrifice for us, and that the wine is symbolic of the blood shed, which is the symbol of life shed by that sacrificial lamb that was smeared, as it was on the first Passover, on the doorway to life, the doorway to God's home, the doorway to immortality. And we begin by eating unyeasted bread on this day, telling us that Passover is part of the celebration of unyeasted bread, and that Passover without unyeasted bread is counterproductive. But Passover with unyeasted bread is the best of all possibilities. We become immortal on Passover. We become perfect on matzah. So we begin Passover by celebrating matzah, including matzah, unyeasted bread, into this marvelous time of parting, of having a great festival feast with God. This is not a somber occasion. God wants us to chag, which is to party, to celebrate what he has done on our behalf. He wants us to feast with him, to dine with him, which is what we'll do in eternity when we're camping out with him. On matzah, as Yosha explained, the stain, the scourge of religion and politics removed from us. It's one thing to walk away from it. It's another thing to have all of its traces removed from our soul so that we appear perfect in God's eyes, so we are vindicated. Because once we've been made immortal, we are made perfect. At that moment, if you look at Passover as the doorway to eternal life into God's home, and matzah as the threshold, as the welcome mat, where all of the rubbish of man is wiped from us so that we can walk into God's home. And on Bukkudim, the third of these three unified days, be adopted into God's family as his children. That's what the covenant is all about. In the covenant, Yahweh is Dad. He is our Heavenly Father. The set-apart spirit is Mom. She is our spiritual mother. And we become God's children, inheriting all that he has to give. Immortal, perfect, enriched and empowered children of God who get to spend all eternity with their Heavenly Father. If that is of interest to you, and if religion and politics no longer is, I encourage you to begin celebrating Pesach, Matzah and Bukkudim with me and with Yahweh beginning this Sunday evening.